Welcome to the Casual Temple Podcast, episode 29, and I'm your host, Merrily Duffy. At the Casual Temple, our mission is to discover our connection to the unseen world of spirit and how that empowers us to know our true selves. But before we start, a little favor, please review us, follow or subscribe, and hit that heart-shaped like button on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we're hanging out with Aidan Wachter, who's a self-described dirt sorcerer and author of Six Ways, Weaving Fate, and Changeling. As a fan of Aidan's work, I dreamed of being able to discuss the influence that music had on his magical path. Lucky for us, Aidan has a really rich musical journey that's run parallel to his magical one. We also discuss the importance of integrating mind, body, and spirit to help be an open conduit in working with the unseen world. We learn how somatic therapies may be helpful for those experiencing anxiety during meditation, and how the act of taking a walk can be key in managing that anxiety. So sit back, relax, and join us for a deep dive into the magical and musical world of Aidan Wachter. Welcome to the Casual Temple. This week, I'm beyond thrilled to have Aidan Wachter as our guest. Aidan has been delving into the realm of magic for more than four decades. An experimenter and an innovator, Aidan has crafted an approach to magic that is as diverse as it is non-dogmatic. His journey, marked by time spent in nature, introspection, and deep breathing, has led to a transformative shift in perspective. Aidan's three books, Six Ways, Weaving Fate, and Changeling, are the documentation of his unique perspective. Aidan, I'm so excited to have you on the Casual Temple.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, thank you so much. I did want to show you, because I know in one of your books you talked about like making tabs of your book.
Awesome. That's my favorite thing. It is totally my favorite thing. Really early on when Six Ways came out, somebody posted one of those and I was like, wow, that's like, I have those books from
other people.
My first copy of Jan Free's book was like demoed. So
yeah, now you make me want to talk about Jan Free's or Jan Free's.
I don't know how you say it, but
Jan, one of those. Well, cool. So now I know I'm a big fan, no secret. But so I think what I wanted to talk about today, if you're open, I think you are, we talked about it. Is sort of your path of music, and I know you're a musician, and how that path kind of led you to where you are, and sort of, I'm sure it was very parallel to your magical path, mainly because I like to get new artist recommendations and stuff like that, so it would help me understand you as a person, and kind of, yeah, I think I'm very excited to know.
Very good, yeah, no, I'm down with that one. I'm always happy to talk. Hang on just a second, though, because I'm getting unstable messages, and I can fix that.
No worries.
Hang on. I am not plugged in directly to my router, and that might help. So let's go to Ethernet. That should settle in a little bit now.
Okay.
Awesome.
Sweet. Yeah, I guess we can. I know you mentioned that you were into punk rock music. So was that sort of your first foray into all of this?
Oh man, kind of. Yeah, you know, I was like, I grew up, you know, the formative childhood years, so like 3 to 13, were in the 70s. So that's what I grew up with, and right at the end of the 70s, I'd already gotten into some weird shit. I got into like Klaus Schulze back then, who's like a, you know, German synthesizer guy who made some pretty weird albums. But I was into all the usuals, you know, at that time, Jethro Tull, Rush, that kind of stuff. And then, yeah, I got turned on by a friend into punk rock with like this, like, now I wish I had it, or at least the set list, but it was a mixtape of everything from Sex Pistols and the Damned and the Avengers and the Dead Kennedys. The Stranglers were on there, I know. And then ended with a couple tracks from Throbbing Gristle. And so super wide ranging.
Yeah.
And when I found that, I was like, oh, I'm all in. to the weird shit. Like, I didn't know the weird shit was really out there. I remember seeing the Sex Pistols on TV when they came through San Francisco on that last tour. They were on the news, but I remember seeing that, hanging out with my grandma. But yeah, it's once I got into that, I was just like, okay, show me. I was like kind of super into hardcore for like a year and a half. And then that really diverged. That got me into the earliest Cure albums and Susie and the Banshees and some of that stuff. And then yeah, then it got weird. Then I got into the weird shit. So
Oh, like what? Oh, now I'm like, what's the weird shit? It's the weird
okay.
shit.
So the weird shit, the story about the weird shit is, oh, let's turn that off. We don't need notifications in this. So me and my friend Aaron and a number of our friends were hanging out. We used to hang out in this little cafe that was really like a Denny's. Like, I think it had been a Denny's that had gone out of business or they moved to a better location. And this other restaurant took on. So if you imagine the inside of an old Denny's, not the current models, but where you had the endless coffee and you could smoke inside because it was, a million years ago. And so it was like nine kind of half jocks, half punks that we hung out, chain smoking and just talking shit and drinking coffee and eating French fries for hours in this place. They must have hated us. But there was another crew in there that we didn't talk to, but they were obviously the other freaks. And I don't know why we never talked to them. But one day they dropped off a book of matches like in front of me with their phone number in it and said, if you'd like to talk, call us. And so my friend and I, Aaron, called them and they said, come over, we'll make you waffles. And we went over to this house and it was kind of the first. So Aaron was like 3 years older than me. So I was 15, 14, 15. Well, it would have been 15. And it was kind of the first anarchist house I'd been in that these people were really not like the people I knew. Really interesting, serious books. And playing us, I think they played us some Stockhausen and they played us some Neu. And then they played us Force the Hand of Chance by Psychic TV. And I was like, what is this? More that it was so weird. I didn't even know if I liked it, but I'm like, this is the weirdest thing I've ever heard. And so I went and bought it. I found a copy of it in Berkeley, took the train into Berkeley and got it and wrote the temple. Because at that point, if you sent them international reply coupons, they would send you something in return. And while I was waiting for that, I like went back into, I think, Rasputin's records in Berkeley and found the guy that I kind of knew from buying punk rock records there was into strange stuff. And I'm like, okay, Force the Hand of Chance, what else should I get? And he hooked me up with Cabaret Voltaire and Current 93 and some Zev and some Non. And I'm sure there was other stuff. Yeah, a few records that I can't remember who put them out. And I'd already gotten into things like Holger Shukai at that point from Can. But I got more into Can at that point. So my musical horizons just kind of jumped from the super just straightforward rock and roll stuff, which is still my all-time favorite thing, but into all this kind of crazed nonsense that just went well with reading very different books than most of my friends, which began to explain what was some of what was different with me. Though it would take me an incredibly long time to kind of label it and go like, oh yeah, I actually have this magical worldview, even though I grew up in the absolute most boring suburbs of California one could hope for at that time. And it was like, oh, okay, if this is the part of the world that makes sense to me, no wonder where I grew up just fucking sucks. Like, beyond what most of my friends thought, it just fucking sucked. Like, yes, it's boring, but it's also going to kill me if I stay in this kind of universe.
Real. Yeah, I think that's what most people, when they have discovered punk rock, have explained, like even the musicians I love who kind of came after punk really, they all say the same, it just like cracked their brain.
Yes.
into being something new. And so it sounds like very similar.
Yeah, because, you know, I was like close enough to Berkeley that with this antenna that I rigged, it was like 30 miles east, but 20 miles east. But if I rigged this antenna just so in my room, I could pick up Maximum Rock and Roll on KPFA. So I got all the hardcore from them. But I hadn't found anything that was kind of playing the super strange shit for the most part for a while. But, you know, that turned me on to, that actually got me sneaking out of the house more and taking Bart into San Francisco and going to hardcore shows when I was 15. So I got to see just dozens of amazing bands. You know, my first ever show was TSOL, The Dead Kennedys in 7 seconds. You know, and that was just like, whoa, if this is what we're doing, I am all about it.
A lot of energy for sure. A lot of different ideas.
Bouncing off the walls.
Literally.
Yeah. It was that particular moment in time was like that whole Nazis punks fuck off thing from Dead Kennedys was right then. And that was an issue.
Right.
There were like big fights. It was not always safe. Because of that. And I'm like super standoffish in general. Yeah. So I didn't actually get to know anybody. That was like one of the retrospectively weird things. Like, no, I just come here to like lose it with you all. And then I'm going to go spend the next 5 hours in Golden Gate Park until the train opens so I can sneak back home before my parents realize I'm gone.
Yeah, you're speaking to me. I'm a little bit like that too. I'm like, in, I got to get out. I got to be by myself for a while.
Yes, that was all the people I can do.
Yeah. Unpeopling for the day, for sure. So you made me think of like, so my kind of era, like I like all like goth bands, like Bauhaus is probably my favorite band.
Yeah.
Susie Banshees, you mentioned. I grew up, or I went to high school here in Everett for a couple of years, right when grunge was like exploded. So that's a big part of my own purview. And then my family dragged me to Stanwood, which you might be familiar with because it's up in sort of your area. Awful for a 14-year-old. It's the worst thing in the universe to be stuck in farm country. But I was like very much vibing with you because you were like, I'm trying to get the antenna signal for my radio station, which was based in Seattle, which was 107.7, because we were out in the country. I'm trying to like bend it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So like that was a funny time because it's like I was going to a ton of shows. I was dating somebody that was super into the grunge scene and kind of related alternative stuff around there.
Yeah.
And like I never got Nirvana, like kind of to this day. It like, I can appreciate it, but I'm not going to listen to it.
Right.
But I'm a huge Alice in Chains fan, like fucking Lane and Jerry Cantrell, fucking amazing.
Yes.
Screaming Trees, I was a fan of because of Lanigan, and I've been a Lanigan fan till he passed a couple of years ago. So he's kind of my voice. If I'm looking for a voice in music for coming out of a male, it's Mark Lanigan.
Is one of the most unique voices ever, for sure.
And I loved Tad. Tad is deeply uncool, I think, but Tad were fucking great.
No, I blast Tad when I'm tuning around Seattle because it sounds badass. I love it.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, Inhaler is one of my all-time favorite records. That's just one of the most hammering records.
Yes, I like that hammering. Like, I guess I call it like sludge. I guess it's sludge rock or whatever. Like the Melvins. I've been listening to a lot of Melvins lately. And so,
I the thing that I haven't listened to the new record from them, but that Crystal Fairy record that they did with Terry Genderbender is like way on my constant rotation. That's one of my favorite records.
Yeah. And they're definitely a group, a band that has like, we're going to do this for this album. You guys figure it out.
Which I totally approve of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I really love that. Oh, wow. That's very cool. Yeah. I think the, definitely know some of the German, the Krautrock too, that you mentioned. And they're pretty cool too. A lot of the like newer bands that I listen to, they're always talking about Neu and Throbbing Gristle. Mm-hmm.
Right.
stuff.
Yeah.
Pretty
What's the
cool.
other stuff from there? Like Faust is great. Like Faust 4, that's a great record. What else did I get into from that kind of stuff? That Aphrodite's Child 666 record is kind of hugely famous when worth it. I really like this band, This Heat, who have a record called Deceit, which is killer and just almost like, yeah, there's parts of it that are like, this is kind of like if Monty Python was like a prog band. It's not normal at
I
all.
like that.
And God, what else did I get into? 'Cause it was kind of that period. I don't know, tons of stuff, but I don't remember it all.
Yeah, I'm
And
sure
then
it'll
kind of
come up later.
90s, yeah, the 90s for me was like, yeah, Nick Cave, Crime and the City Solution. I'm a huge Roland S. Howard fan who was both in Crime and the City Solution and in The Birthday Party, but I like him better than any of the other bands. There was a band from Davis, like the Cal University, in the Northern California, big ag school, called Thin White Rope, who are really amazing. I saw them probably 30 times. They were so good. And then, Sonic Youth, and then my favorite band out of the 90s was Live Skull. Just
Ooh.
straight up Live Skull is, that's the soundtrack of. Previous to
Gotcha.
that, yeah, like in my 15, 16, it was like The Cure. And then later on, it was Live
Oh.
Skull, yeah.
Okay, yeah, because that was actually sort of one of the questions I was going to ask. Like, if there was a biopic made about you, what would be on the
Oh man,
soundtrack
yeah, totally.
since
It's such a weird blend. Yeah, the
then?
Flesh Eaters,
Ooh, yeah, Flesh Eaters.
coming from the, yeah, but only like, yeah, the Forever Came Today and A Hard Road to Follow, that band, which was the more rock and roll band version of it. Definitely the first, yeah, like 17 Seconds, Faith and Pornography from The Cure. And then all of Live Skull, they just got back together and their stuff's fine. But, well, the main guy has got a new band using the same name. But the Live Skull records are amazing. Incredibly bleak and just angular and weird. So, good shit.
That. Wow, cool. Yeah, that definitely sounds like a soundtrack I would be into. Very cool. Now this seems like a so I know you do a lot of long bike rides. Do you listen to music on those bike rides at all, or do you are you
No.
completely just nope?
No, I don't. Yeah, no, I don't do music when I do that.
Yeah, makes sense. It's
Yeah,
kind of
no, that's one of those
meditative.
things. It's kind of meditative, and I try and do it out in nature as much, and I just kind of get. I was talking to somebody a couple of weeks ago that was. I was showing the woods around here. Like, I think that part of my function in this world is to wander around in nature and like coo about it. Like, fuck, you're cool. Fuck, you're so cool. I love the moss. It's so cool. So that's what I'm doing.
It. Oh my gosh, amazing. I'm sure nature appreciates all the peeling.
It may not, but it's gonna happen anyway.
Yes, we're gonna like think you're cool and you're, we're gonna have it. Amazing.
Absolutely.
Now this is like, so what similarities do you see in sort of this, how I'm tying them together, like music and magic? I see it all the time.
Oh man. Yeah.
Yeah.
So to me, like, and while it's ostensibly a book on sigils, this is actually kind of the other piece of it is the book that I'm working on now kind of discusses this. So one way we could think about magic, if you're an animist like I am, or even if you're thinking about it psychologically, there's other models that may not, this may not work as well, but is that these different practices are different ways of speaking, that it's a communication tool. That there's this, that if we kind of pull it aside from that, we're going to impose our will upon the system and instead subdivide that and go, okay, instead, what if what we're doing with all of these different actions that we do is we're creating different languages or different sentences or maybe different ways of using languages and sentences. So some things are poetry and some things are technical manuals, right? And so different ways of approaching magic and different people's approaches are going to be speaking to different parts of the psyche and then different parts of the system, right? Because if you're just talking to yourself, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But if you're talking, trying to communicate to other people, you have to work harder
yes.
to get it across, right?
Yes.
And so I think this is how this is what I think music is to me and why music is such a magical thing, is somebody is having that communication with me without having any way of knowing that I'm receiving it as they intend it. So I look at, like there's music that I listen to specifically when I know that I have grief stuff that's blocked because it will just cause me to break down.
Yeah.
And it's not something I'm great at. So it's like, okay, time to go listen to some things that will let me get this out of my system. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a way I can kind of look at those and go that for me, whatever the intention was of that person, these are kind of spells of road opening for my grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this with a lot of stuff. So I like that last, I have never listened to anything other than Techno Train, but that like half of the Electric Callboy album that came out a couple of years ago, I think, is like my super happy music.
Mm-hmm.
Like Dua Lipa is like super happy music to me. Like, okay, if I'm like almost there, but I'm not there, and I know that it's just because I've got too much shit in my head, I can use music to move beyond that. And so music is this communication between the artist and me, but then it becomes, once it's recorded, this tool that I can pull out of the toolkit whenever I need it to do whatever I needed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like super odd one that I was thinking about the other day. I've listened to Hounds of Love every time I've flown since that record came out.
Really?
Like for whatever reason, like when they make you buckle your seatbelts, I turn that on. And so I've taken off to that first track every single flight I've been on in whatever it is, 30 years.
Wow.
And it's like this super weird little magic thing, and it just makes every flight perfect, you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's so funny, because now I'm like thinking of the little things that I tend to do with that too. I think there's like a New Order, gosh, what is that song? I'm trying to remember it. They had it for the Real World, like the title track, like they played this New Order song. Every time I've moved into it, and when I moved into my first place, like on my own, I played that song. And so now every time I move into a new place, I play that song.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
It kind of sets the tone of like being independent and, you know, on my own, but, you know, but missing home kind of thing.
Absolutely. And I also think, yeah. You know, like, and then there's music that also just changes how I think.
Mm.
Like I'm a huge fan of this guy, Chris Whitley, because he changes what I think. Like he's like really not, he's probably not clear enough for most people. He's a hard sell for most people. And for those of us who are into him, we just fucking, the dude was just fucking astounding. But it's like, the majority of his songs, I don't know what they're about.
Mm.
And I've been listening to them for 20 years. Like, I don't know. Like, different days, I have different thoughts about it. And he was really clearly not trying to tell you a coherent story. He was very much viewing this as some kind of poetry.
Mm.
And he talks about that. And it was one of the things that I thought was really cool about him is I heard an interview with him. They said, so what is your like approach to songwriting? He goes, well, I think everybody's really boring for the most part because it's all so clear.
Mm.
And he goes, and to me, like the perfect song ever is this Howlin' Wolf song, which I don't know if you know or not, but called Smokestack Lightning.
Mm.
Check it out.
Yeah.
And from that perspective of, and he says, and what is that song really about? It's really hard to tell. Like, it's not, he's like, you know, people have, this is what he's talking about. And maybe he said, this is what he's talking about, but just listening to it, it's about something on a visceral level that maybe doesn't actually have a cognitive, like a conscious cognitive version, you know? And Chris is like that for me, that there's shit of, there's songs of his that I absolutely love that periodically I'll go like, what do I think that he's even talking about here? And it's like, I don't know, but it's like crushing. It's crushing, you know?
Hey, I like that. Sounds like the like Swans, kind of the similar sort of, yeah, so I
I was a
definitely check
big
it out.
Swan. I was a big Swans fan.
I
I was
know.
lucky enough to see them a few times back in the day. I saw them for Children of God and
Oof.
two things after. I can't remember what the other ones were, but really killer band.
It's like the same thing. I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about, but speaking to something in me.
Oh
So,
yeah, I know. I have a great Swan story from back then. I was like probably 17 and maybe a little bit older because I was at that bookstore for a while. And so I was working at a Tower bookstore that was attached to a Tower record store as they were. And so the bookstore was filled with music freaks as well, you know. This guy Serge, and Serge somewhere is out in the world, so I won't say his last name, but he moved here, moved there from Russia. And so he was this kind of, I think he was a drummer or a bass player, total metalhead, like 18 years old, beard down to his waist, because he's, you know, that kind of guy. And so he's dropping off various music, and we're checking it out. And I gave him a cop, I gave him a cassette of Holy Money by the Swans. And he came back in the next day, and he's like, in that super burly, super fresh off the boat accent, he's like, this isn't metal, but it's heavy as fuck.
Yes
It's like, you understand, my friend. You know, loved them.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good one. I love those, like, trading. That's something that's missing, is like trading those tapes with people is like the best
It's
thing
such a
ever.
thing. You know, it's I was thinking about it. One of the things that I do enjoy about the online world is such a weird one, and I finally figured out why, which is I like watching reaction videos to music that I love. I like watching people hear it for the first time, and it's because I used to do that. I remember I got the Japanese import of Pornography by The Cure before it was released in the US. And took it over to my friend Don's house and put it on while he was in the bathroom and got him loaded and said, tell me what band this is, and put it on. And he was like, I don't know, is this Public Image? And he's the guy who turned me on to The Cure because it was such a
Oh,
violent
that is
change.
hilarious. Yeah.
And I'm like, no, it's the fucking new Cure record. And he's like, wow, you know? And I miss that whole thing of sitting in a room with somebody playing music that they have not heard before and watching them groove on it.
Gosh. Now I'm like, I need to watch music reaction
It's a horrible rabbit hole, but
videos. Yeah, sure.
it's my definite time sucker. When I need just to zone out, that's what I do.
Yeah, and it's super positive, I would assume, for the most part.
Oh yeah, it's like you just find people that you're kind of like, oh yeah, I want to see this person deal with Layne Staley. Let's see.
Exactly. Yeah. Lane's amazing voice. And what are you talking about, Lane? You know, for sure. Oh my gosh. Wow. Yeah, so definitely, and I know you're so we talked definitely about music, and I know you mentioned sort of books in your writing as well. And would you say that there are similar kind of paths with books in your life that were influential?
Yeah, and I have to throw Monster Magnet in there because I missed them, and I'm a diehard Dave Windorf freak, and
Oh, okay,
everyone,
yeah.
anybody is welcome to judge me because yes, it is incredibly ridiculous and fantastic. But yeah, so I remember I was reading like kid books, you know, in elementary school, young adult stuff. And then in fourth grade, I read The Lord of the Rings. And that was really cool. And then that like opened up this whole thing about science fiction and fantasy. And so I kind of started with the stuff that like the adults were like legit with for kids, which is like Ray Bradbury and Isaac Asimov. But I really got into some fucked up shit really fast. And by sixth grade, I was kind of like, what's the weirdest shit I can find? And that got me heavily into Michael Moorcock,
Oh, yes.
which got me into Hawkwind. So that was a direct interrelation, which was a big thing. And because of that, when I was, when I was 11, I got into Moorcock because my brother bought me a calendar that was Rodney Matthews, who's also famous for his album cover art for Nazareth and things like that. And it was all fantasy, and it was all illustrations based on Michael Moorcock stories. And I'd never read any Moorcock, and so I found Moorcock, started reading his stuff, and shortly after that, I had an interaction in a dream with the man in black in the bookstore that I went to buy science fiction in Berkeley. And that was kind of the switch that turned me into whatever it is I am now. That's a straight up. I have a straight on, straight up, visionary experience sent me down this road, so.
I like that it was like a book that did that for you, and especially since it seemed like your, at least your musical influences were kind of prog rock, and they all did the fantasy, you know, they did all the fantasy stories in there.
It was all like, yeah, it's like either prog rock or like, yeah, just like super jamming stuff or like, let's go kill ourselves in the rain, goth stuff, you know?
For sure.
So I got into that stuff and it didn't know that that was a magical event, but the whole experience stuck with me. And previous to that, I was different. I know that. Like, my life radically changed after that. And part of that was within another couple of years, I bought Book Four by Crowley and Earth Power by Scott Cunningham and The Spiral Dance by Starhawk. And it would have been right in there. That would have come in right before. And then in 82, I would have gotten the Grey Book from the Temple of Psychic Youth and Ralph Bloom's book on runes. And so all of that stuff kind of sent me in like, okay, this is what I'm interested in. This is what what is making sense. And then I had exposure through my dad's books on the first three Castaneda books, which retrospectively I could see really informed my worldview. Like it didn't stick, but if I think about how I think about magic, there's more in that than there is in Crowley or in the Spiral Dance or something like that. In that it's this super kind of peculiar between the worlds transvisionary stuff.
Yeah, I guess that was something I was thinking about too, in books that, you know, so of course you read a lot of magical books, but it seemed like the things that maybe weren't quote unquote magical, like the Moorcock books and then the Castaneda books were the ones that really kind of shifted things for you, it sounds like, in a way.
Yeah, I think I was looking specifically for a different worldview. And so I think I had to find the people who were really unapologetic about that worldview, which I got both in some rock and roll. I got it in some science fiction and fantasy. So Castaneda was like that, and then some fantasy stuff was, because generally it's like I could kind of look at like Starhawk stuff, and I was really too young to kind of get the politic there, and I was never really wired to the politic. Like I think from a really early age, I was like, the world is insane. And so assuming that there's a social way to undo social insanity, I don't think I ever really bought all the way. And I was definitely too young to really grasp kind of the feminist stuff in there, though that became very important later on. And Crowley, I read Crowley for a long time trying to figure out what it was, and I was finally like, I don't believe this guy. Like, I don't think he knows what he hasn't experienced. Like, I think he was so in his head, and it's not saying he didn't experience a lot of shit, but he was clearly so cerebral that I was like, that's a different universe than mine. I think it's very much a lot of people's universe. And then later on, kind of coming into the kind of ideas of neurodivergence and things like that, that began to make more sense of like, oh yeah, if I think about Crowley, Crowley was not neurodivergent. That's really clear. You go, no, that's the, he's not showing any of that. But Spare, quite possibly, and so I think I was looking for different narratives about reality more than I was looking for technique most of the time. And it took me a long time to realize that. And so I got more from reading on, Haitian voodoo, though I never practiced it, because it was showing a different way of thinking. A lot of both indigenous written and then anthropology about indigenous cultures, primarily US indigenous cultures. This is again when I was really young. Retrospectively, I can see I was looking for a worldview that didn't seem as fucked up as the one that I was surrounded by. And so that was really all kind of super crucial to that. And then kind of, I mean, it's like, I think Kenneth Grant was more useful to me than Crowley was, because again, it's like, this guy's a nut job. What it does, it's like, clearly this didn't happen the way that he described it. This was my brain reading Kenneth Grant early on. Like, 'cause we would know if all of these people were dead that are apparently dead, but it turned me on to folks that were influential just in their being unapologetic. Grant for one, Michael Berteaux of the Gnostic Vodun workbook, not my thing, that whole thing, not my thing, but unapologetic. Like, this is weird, this is way beyond woo weird, this is, and then that was also the thing, was that's like, I had exposure to people who were Wiccans, who were New Age folks, who were whatever, who were badass. And I knew a lot of ceremonialists, and I was in the chaos scene for a while, who really looked down on that. And sometimes it was funny because I was like, I know 70-year-old women who would smoke your ass if you decided to have a magical battle with them. And they're just New Age little Twinkies that if they got you in their crosshairs and thought you were a menace to society, you would not be anymore, And so I was really open, like, this doesn't have to look any particular way. Ramsey Dukes was really helpful for me. His book SSOTBME is kind of a really formative book, because he was looking at, like, have you read that book? Worth reading. Sex Secrets of the Black Magicians Exposed.
Whoa.
But that's not what it's about, which is why I like Ramsey. But it's looking at, he basically comes in and he says, okay, so what if we put forward a model that said there are four different ways that one could look at the world and you could view and experience the world, and that is the artistic, the religious, the scientific, and the magical. And they become kind of a Venn diagram. So it's not that it's one or the other, you're going to have different degrees of intersection. And so to me, it was like, okay, this guy is actually thinking about the thinking behind the actions, which to me is interesting because it gets behind the mythology. Like, we have a huge respect, or there is a huge respect, I think, because it's got links into academia, and because both the Golden Dawn and a lot of the United States pagan groups, even the UK pagan groups as well, have folklore backgrounds. Like, a lot of folklore scholars. So that's really accepted as this is a way that you can look at this stuff and make it reasonable. And I was always kind of like, but what if it's not reasonable? What if what's actually going on really is kind of a level of extremity over that? So like I began looking at folklore and going, well, a lot of folklore is explicitly anti-magic, and it's anti-individuality. Like the stories are what happens to you if you stray. Like that's not magic. That's
Right.
anti-magic. And you know, reading a book by John Crowley called Egypt, and I think it's been released under a different name, but it's a three book series of fantasy books. And great if you're into occultism, because John Dee is a character in it, Giordano Bruno is a character in it. But it's a kind of these incursions of the past into these people in a small town. One of the kind of recurring themes in it, and I don't remember if this is the language he uses or not, is he basically says, you know, things were once not as they are now. And that really stuck with me because to me, that was the thing I was looking for as I was going, okay, I think we got off, this is me personally, no judgment on anybody that's happy with this place, but I think that we got off track really bad at some point. And it doesn't mean I want to go back to what was, but that we threw the baby out with the bathwater. And so I began running off of a different kind of explanation model that said, okay, if I read this thing that says this guy would, this witch or whatever, would do this thing and would be transported into another world, I'm going to take that at face value. Now, I don't know what is meant by was transported into another world. So I don't necessarily believe that that happens physically in any sense that we would understand as physical now. But that opened me up, I think, to kind of my experience of trance work, of going, ah, yes, I do that. I go into other worlds that are as real as this one and are often far more impactful. And so, which is the real world? And I think that all used to be closer for humanity in general. And I think that we see this in kind of the records that have been made by a really unsympathetic people among indigenous populations throughout the world. You know, if 100 years ago people hadn't been quite such shits, we would have really good information that we don't. To me, that's a huge piece of magic, as you go, okay, so it's not Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces, no issues with that, it's good material. But what if what we broadest umbrella call magic is a way to actively connect with very real worlds that are critical to our survival as a species, and that the divorce from that has us where we are now, which is what I believe and what my allies tell me. And so, you know, it's kind of funny because I get a, this is why I'm behind the paywall of Patreon for the most part, but anymore is so many people want to go, yeah, but everything is natural. And you go, well, it depends what you mean. Would it have come about without you or without our kind? So, like, no, this lovely Rode microphone would never have manifested. You know, this computer would never have manifested. And yes, they're awesome. I love them. But we're disembodied from the physical in a way, which was kind of, I think, an intentional move of Western industrialism. And the thing that had to go for that to happen was this connection to what I am calling magic in its broadest sense.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. I'm thinking a lot because I've been working with some of my ancestral spirits as well. And so, and I've been thinking a lot about the because my dad was Irish American, my mom is Filipino, both cultures kind of like their history is pretty much removed for the most part, is you know. But sort of what I've kind of gotten from the the ancestors that I've communicated with is sort of doing sort of trance excavation with them of like sort of those past histories. Now where that butts up against is, I think maybe is the material world, right? Because in our material world, they say, oh, but you need the anthropology evidence of this and this and this and this and this. And so I think that that's where we sort of have that disconnect of kind of where you're talking about, we're sort of all up in the mind and not really down into the body in the material world.
Well, that's what's interesting is to use the modern terms and the stuff that based on what I've been playing with, it's like a somatic disconnect. Whereas that psyche soma thing is intended, if we look at psyche in its earlier form, as I love to quote, is, you know, body, mind, spirit.
Yeah.
Which is an interlaced thing. It's a singular thing. It's not three different things.
Right.
And I think that move is, how do you get people into the city and into the factory? You have to generate that separation.
Right.
Because who's going to walk into that? Especially as shitty as it was back then, you know?
Yeah.
Like, really? Like, I'm sorry, we may go, ooh, yeah, I don't want to go plow the fields.
Right.
But plowing the fields versus digging in the coal mine, I'm plowing the fields, babe.
Yeah.
That's a way better way to spend 40 hours a week. You know, both are going to have a physical toll. Mm-hmm. And then you get into, you know, early kind of youth child labor industrialism, which still we export to other places now, it still goes on. You go, that's not, this is where the allies won't let me be correct, that's not right. You know, I want to say it's not correct, but they're like, no, it's not right. That's not something that you should do if you're looking for something called health or wellness. You know, and you can come up with a billion arguments for it, but they're all going to be cerebral.
Yeah.
None of those are going to be true in the body.
Yeah.
And so to me, that's how do you mesh kind of this body and spirit aspect without throwing out the intellect?
Right.
But how do you put it in into something like an equal partnership? Instead of going, but we have to have all of the scientific proof. And if anything, it's very clear right now that really only ever exists for like 10 minutes, you know,
right.
And then it gets changed with the new scientific truth and you go, okay, so how is this helping us to attach to it in kind of a religious fashion, which is what, and the answer is it allows kind of domination. And it allows that separation because people, if you were to connect everybody back to their kind of spiritual core, like the whole planet all at once, the people in power today would not be in power beyond tomorrow.
No,
it's like, oh yeah, no, half of us could die to take care of this. That would be okay. Right. That's the correct thing. So you go, okay, yeah, that's easy. That's easy math. You go, you know.
Yeah. And I think that's something in your books, you definitely, so, you know, I was kind of re-looking at them before we had a chance to talk, and you have this very, I call it like synesthetic way of writing, where it's like, it kind of hits all of those things. It hits like the mind, body, spirit. And so it's like, oh, okay, yeah, like getting, and then a lot of your techniques are very much in, you know, describing all of that, like getting into your body, like discernment too, which does have that sort of intellectual component of like, what are you, you know, asking yourself questions and like, you know, all of that. So I think that's really great. So how do you think, so if your body is a separate entity and independent of the mind, why is it important to distinguish both?
It's not, and this is actually an interesting thing. So the current kind of, I'm going to say the kind of current scientific materialism model, which is breaking down, would say that the mind is over the body, is how I would say it if we were thinking of it hierarchically.
Right.
But functionally, we don't have that without the body. So the mind is the body,
right?
And the body is the mind. What happens, I think, is that if we're disconnected from the actual experience that we're actually having in the body, we become incredibly disconnected from ourselves. We're like literally non-functional because communication isn't happening both ways. So like I've seen this a million times in my life, and I imagine you have too, where you like know something is not what you should do, and you like literally talk yourself into it because you can't find the proof that satisfies that scientific materialist aspect of your consciousness to just go, now I know that that's right, and I'm going with it, right?
Right.
Because again, it's like, if we were to remove, just to bring it down to the moment, and I won't go too political, but because it's the obvious situation, yeah. If we were to remove all of the story from what's happening in Gaza right now, and it was just, this is what is happening here, or this is what's happening in all over the place, Africa, Haiti, for God's sake. And we removed all of the stories, because there's tons of stories about why it's okay for these things to happen to the people it's happening to.
Right.
And so if we remove that talk and we're just shown that, I think that as an animal who has some respect for other animals, people would go like, yeah, that's not good.
Right.
That's not what I want to have happen to people.
Yeah.
And it's this layering of story and not good story, because it's story with an agenda. It's not a story that's trying to explain reality.
Right.
It's a story that's trying to constrain reality to a particular end, right?
Right.
And so really it's an integration that we're looking for, is how do you get to where you can say, okay, yeah, we've got all this tech, we've got all this medicine, we've got all of these, this ability to manufacture. And we know that perhaps 90% of that is pointed towards ends that aren't actually generally beneficial.
Right.
Like, yes, they benefit particular people, but they're not beneficial to the system as a whole. So in a sense, what we have is, you know, it's, and again, it's like, it's not that humanity is this parasitic cancer, but, which is a point of view I have held at different points in my life. But instead that the way that we've arranged kind of our societal structures, which is our mental structures and how we think and how we communicate about it, allows those who wish to operate in that way,
right,
in an extractive way, to do so, because we can't find the specific proof that is universally accepted to say, no, that's just bad magic. And we don't do bad magic anymore, because we want to be here in 500 years.
Yeah. I like that perspective of like kind of looking at a situation without, and then just maybe feeling in your body. Cause if you think, I'm thinking of my cats, but like if my cats were to see like a group of cats fighting, you know, or whatever, you know, they would have like a specific reaction, whether it is to jump in or, you know, try to calm somebody down. Like it wouldn't be wound up in the story of who did what, you know, they would just observe what is happening.
Well, it's funny. It's like, I have, you know, I had goats when I lived out in the country, and these huge livestock guardian dogs who were raised by other livestock guardian dogs and other goats, not by me. I just fed them, gave them water, and got them vetted by having the vet come out. Like they'd never been indoors.
Oh, wow.
Anywhere, you know? They were really cool to learn from, because it's like, you know, they had games that they played with the ravens. And the ravens, some of the ravens figured out games that they could play with them.
Wow.
And they would totally, there was rules, you know, it's, and there was times you did this, and there was a particular thing. You landed on this particular post and started talking. And if the dogs were into it,
yeah,
they would get up and come over, and then they would play these games. And likewise, our dogs were bonded to, in order, each other, the goats, and then us. You know, if I had tried to, because we weren't harvesting our goats, if I had tried to kill one of my goats, my dogs would have taken me out. Wow. I think no problem. Like, nope, that's actually my pack. You're my person, and that's cool. We like you, but this is my world, you know?
Yeah.
And so the thing that was really interesting is they were like super judicious. So like the coyotes would come by, they'd talk to the coyotes. They clearly liked the coyotes as long as they were on the other side of the fence. Mm. Coyote comes in after the livestock. No, that's not acceptable. But are they going to like go hunt down all the coyotes? No, they totally dug the coyotes. The coyotes are like, cool. They're like,
right.
You know, they're the roamers. They get news. I think the coyotes would probably give them news from what was going on for miles around. And our dogs were like, that's awesome, dude. Stay the fuck away from my goat.
Yeah. Just stay over there.
You know? And so I think it is that thing. It's like, we're really weird in that we, can generate again, story that says, we can take all of something and destroy to whatever extent, and it'll be okay because we're really smart. We'll figure it out. We always do. You know? And, you know, it's like, I think they now think that we've been probably talking for like 100,000 years. Like, we really haven't been around all that long.
Right.
In our current form. We haven't had this kind of power for more than, you know, depending on what day you pick it up, yesterday or 200 years ago or 500 years ago. And I think we're just children and don't know what we're doing with it. So.
Yes. I couldn't agree more. It's definitely sort of deprogramming those stories of what your body and your spirit and your whole being knows is either right or wrong or however you view it.
Yeah.
But yeah. It's just like getting those out of there, man.
Yeah, and it's just, and then it's just like, you know, it's super interesting when I think when you look at it that way, because you look at, okay, you know, we've generated the ability to like weirdly feed the planet multiple times over and yet have a ton of people starving to death.
Yeah.
And the people who get to eat everything they want to are really sick. What's the fucking combo there? Like, this is not hard to sort. If you want to throw the money out there and stop listening to the people that don't want you to do this, right. You know, it's all fixable. And so that's the thing that's really kind of interesting and depressing. Is it's
like, I know. You're like, it's so easy. It's so hard.
No reason for any of this.
Yeah.
It's like, this isn't get their maximum dividend this year.
Right. Oh, man. Yeah, and I know that you have this discussion in Dara Mason's Spirit Box Discord, which is a really fun and great community.
It is.
Regarding sort of movement and meditation. And the thing, I'm going to paraphrase you, you can definitely correct me. But what I remember was, you know, you said something about like, people don't move enough in today's world, like probably in the Western world. And meditation is saying you got to sit still. And you were maybe like, how about we move a little bit more?
You know, it's a 50-50 thing. It's sit still is a great thing if you can. Right. And this goes kind of more specifically into somatics as the language is used now, into kind of somatic experiencing coming from Peter Levine's school of things. Mm-hmm. Lots of the polyvagal theory stuff from Stephen Porges and Deb Dana, and it's that stuff that's very big right now, and for good reason. I think there's an incredible amount of good in there. I used to be very much of the, if you're wigging out, you should spend more time doing sitting meditation. Until I got into kind of personal high anxiety modes, and I went, oh, and it's impossible. Interesting. I didn't know. I didn't have that at that point in time. Uh-huh. Interesting. God, I'm an asshole. Because I've got 30 years of suggesting this to people that I really, you know, from an AA standpoint, owe amends to. But You know, Darren and I were really talking about, like, at the point that, like, I get to the actual peak of my crazed levels of anxiety, the way that I started to get out of it was just walking myself to exhaustion, basically. Because it would get me settled. It's like over time, it would get me settled in a way that I couldn't do. I couldn't regulate that aspect of my neurology. But I could be fine if I walked. And I retrospectively know that that probably led to my, like, long distance running and my bicycling and my weightlifting and all the stuff that I've done over the years were ways that I was regulating that I didn't know, which also allowed me to then meditate when I was able to, you know. And so it's, again, it's not separable. And then there's a weird thing that I think is kind of relevant, which is that when we look at meditation, we kind of have to, depending on what we're doing with it, we kind of have to also look at what is the story behind what we're doing. Because sometimes that story is the one that I'm not really fond of, which is your body and your bodily drives and your bodily knowledge is wrong because it's not rational, which I don't agree with. I think it's differently rational. And so if we're kind of fixated on that view, I don't think that we're not getting what is helpful to me. And I think this is kind of, it goes into what we were talking about before we started talking. Whatever way you kind of map people, whether that's through neurotypicality and neurodivergence, whether it's human design and generators and manifesting generators and projectors or whatever, just the zodiac signs, introvert, extrovert, all of these things that are ways to try and explain how we're different while being essentially the same structurally, the wiring is different. And so I think when we look at the meditation stuff, the more I tried to go into forms that were really trying to get me separated from my body in some ways, the less well I was. Because to me, I can't operate that way. I'm definitely, like, supposed to be really in my body, and my body is where I get my knowledge from. I don't think into much. I discover through my body what's going on, and then through using all of me, I'm able to come up with solutions that generally will work for me. They won't necessarily work for anybody else. And so I think that that is, it's, yeah. So, you know, now I would pull back on my meditation recommendations for anybody that says, if you find you're getting more anxious, I would be looking at things like somatically based either therapies or counseling methods or just polyvagal release methods, things like that, to try and settle that. Because that's more important to me than you being able to sit for an hour. Because if you're agitated through that whole thing, you're not getting any clarity. And if you can get relaxed in a world that is really not designed for us to be relaxed, and is kind of designed to be have us agitated, that's probably more important for most people right now. I know it is for me. It's like, no, it's like, what do I have to do to not be reactive, on a really base level, not at a high level? That's something that can come in whatever times it comes, you know.
Yeah, thank you for explaining that, 'cause it's definitely something when I either work with people or talk with people about, 'cause they're like, they want to also have sort of experiences with talking with their beings or their allies or their guides, and they're having a lot of trouble. And, the general thing is like, sit and meditate. But if you have all this other stuff going on, maybe it is great to explore somatics or polyvagal or even exercise, go for a nice long walk, see if that clears some stuff up.
Right, and realize that, like, you know, I've talked about it before, but, you know, it's there's really cool wiring stuff too, like the whole EMDR, I think, is essentially a way of physically triggering the effects that we have of walking through an environment, that it produces the same kind of stimulation that the optic flow of the world passing by you, which has major, major neurological effects and allows you to let go of things. And it allows you to think different things. This is like known by the neuroscience community. And so there's a reality to that, which again, then if we also look at that, you go, so everybody goes, well, I'll just go to the gym and walk on the treadmill. Do you have the option to not do that? And I understand not everybody does, because it's not the same thing. Because then the world isn't passing you by. And so it's not just the movement, it's the movement through space and your perception as you move through space is what you get from walking or running or cycling. It's not just the fact that you get a particular kind of cardiovascular exercise. That's not it at all. I mean, it's not it in total.
Yeah, it's making me think like, yeah, it's basically, yeah, move, the actual movement through space. You're literally in a different headspace, like moving through different spaces.
Well, and
Cool.
again, I think it makes so much sense because it's kind of humans as localized in space for long periods of time is very new. If we look at again, and I take a really long view. I don't care when we started talking. I think that we've been basically as we are for a long time, several hundreds of thousands of years at least. I don't think that the animal has changed. I think our higher brain changed, but we're mostly the animal, no matter what. We were mostly really mobile. That whole nomadism, hunter-gatherers, all of that stuff. We're spending huge amounts of time moving through space. And so if we look at, it's kind of interesting, there's in all of the office health things you'll ever see where they give out the pedometers and say, well, they want you to get 10,000 steps, which is about 6 miles, right? So if you look at that, and then you look at kind of the ethnography of modern hunter-gatherers, in general, they say that most of those people move between 6 and 10 miles a day. So you could link that up and say, okay, so it's this 10 to 15,000 steps a day is the key. And you go, no, because they're actually moving through a world that they're completely engaged in. They're having optic flow for hours. They're having communication with themselves, with each others in that moving state for hours a day. This is not the same thing as going and watching the news on a treadmill or listening to a podcast on a treadmill. And it's going to have a very different effect. And I think especially if you're viewing the world magically, that's not hard to then extrapolate out and go, oh, how do I best operate to get these things happening in a way that the animal is designed for them to happen, which to me I think is also probably why I've always, not always, but I've generally had a lot of access to the trance worlds, is I've very rarely been a driver and I'd prefer not to be on the bus. So I'm generally walking miles or riding miles every day. And so I think parts of me get to settle out almost every day that probably don't for a lot of people.
That's so cool. Yeah, I'm definitely gonna be thinking about that and thinking I need to go for more walks for sure. My goodness. Yeah, thanks, Aiden. So definitely, yeah, so many things that you said I'm going to be thinking about for many days now for sure. Do you have any sort of, so we're kind of ending here, but do you have any sort of upcoming projects or events that you want us to know about or?
Not specifically. I'm going to be traveling for a good number of months, so that's what's coming up for me. I've kind of, as I kind of hinted at earlier, I've pretty much moved my entire online existence into Patreon, which is awesome. It's
It is
really
fun.
good. It's way more manageable for my world. And so that's where most of my attention goes. And I've been cranking out videos in there. I try and get out 4 videos a month. sometimes more, sometimes less. And that'll continue while I'm traveling.
Cool.
But that's most of what I have going on.
Nice. Yeah, I would definitely suggest. I am in your Patreon. I'm just kind of quiet at the moment, but I'm definitely there. And there's like great community. Your videos are amazing. You're very engaging with the community. So I highly, highly recommend it.
Thank you. I'm glad. Yeah, no, I'm glad that it's working for people. I was like, really like, I don't know if anybody's going to care about this at all, but right. You never know.
You never know.
So
yeah,
it's been good.
Oh, yeah, I'm so thankful for that. And that you made that community. So that's amazing. So generally you have given us so many words of wisdom, but is there any sort of last words of wisdom that you would like to leave us with today?
Well, I'm just going to speak to the people in the U.S. or the people that are connected to the U.S. Like, I would strongly suggest maybe right now, because it's not a bad time, because things will not level out, of taking a little space and figure out how you're going to do the next 6 or 7 months. Because it's going to be messy. Particularly in the news world and in the social media world, it's like we've all done that. Most of us have done this before. Not everybody was necessarily online the last time that this went around, but this is a particularly ugly election cycle and will only continue. And so I would suggest for the magically inclined folks, figure out now how you want to address that, because you could choose.
It's true. Great advice. Definitely hear that from like,
I'm going to go ride my bike in the middle of nowhere.
I'm like, that seems like the best solution.
I'm going to go camping for the next 6 months.
Genius. Oh man. For sure. Well, it's definitely going to be those times. They'll be interesting to observe for sure and live in. Well, yeah, thank you, Aiden. That was great advice.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
No, it's a pleasure.
What a fun conversation with Aiden Wachter. I hope you found some new music to listen to. I know I did. As usual, you can find the links to Aiden's website and works in the show notes. Do remember to like, follow, and subscribe on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us grow. Thank you for listening and being an awesome part of the Casual Temple.